This is Fresh Air. Many of George Bush's critics thought he focused on foreign policy at the expense of issues closer to home, and that's why he lost the election. My guest Charles Cobb agrees. Cobb was Bush's deputy assistant for domestic policy. He worked in the Reagan administration, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Education Department. When he came to the Bush White House in 1990, he hoped Bush would carry on the Reagan agenda. He's written a new memoir called White House Daze, that's D-A-Z-E, The Unmaking of Domestic Policy in the Bush Years. It chronicles Cobb's frustrations as he tried to get the administration to pay attention to domestic issues. He says his efforts were constantly blocked.
First of all, I think inside the White House, people defined the wrong problem at the very outset. Dick Darman and Nick Brady and others, I think, convinced George Bush that the problem was the deficit and the need to engage in significant deficit reduction. Others of us in the White House thought that the problem was related but very different, and that is we would have liked to have seen the problem defined as economic growth. I think if that had happened and efforts had not been blocked in that respect, you would, incidentally, have gotten deficit reduction at the same time. Remember, that was happening at the end of the Reagan administration. So I would put that the issue of economic growth versus deficit reduction as one of the issues where a number of us tried to do things differently and were blocked. I think the whole economic empowerment agenda that Jack Kemp, among others, and some of us in the White House tried to push was another area where it was blocked. In part, the president just wasn't interested, but Darman and others really didn't see it as a defining issue for the Republicans. And what we have seen, ironically, is that Bill Clinton and some of the new Democrats around him are taking a lot of the themes and ideas such as welfare reform and economic empowerment and making it part of a Democratic administration. I think that's a real tragedy for George Bush.
I'm interested in the process at the White House by which you try to get your ideas across and the process by which you say domestic policy ideas were blocked. Let's start with your boss, the domestic policy advisor, Roger Porter. You say that he insisted that everybody just study the issues forever, and you think that studying and studying and studying was an effective way of making sure nothing happened.
Well, it can be if that's all you do. But let me go back to your point about process in the White House. I think process is important, but unfortunately that, in many respects, is all we had. We became sort of process pragmatists, and many of us, rather than have process, would like to have seen more in the way of progress. But let me give you an example. When I got to the White House in May of 1990, I was asked to head something called the Low Income Opportunity Board. That had been created at the end of the Reagan administration, and it was basically a vehicle to pursue an aspect of economic empowerment, if you will, or welfare reform. And I found, when I got to the White House, frankly, there was no interest in that activity. Sununu wanted to distance it, wanted to get the staff handling it out of the White House.
Sununu was chief of staff at the time.
John Sununu was chief of staff to George Bush. And, of course, Jack Kemp, one of the more activist conservatives in the Bush cabinet, wanted to do the exact opposite. And so we had this big to-do for a couple of months as to, first of all, whether to have it, secondly, where to have it, thirdly, who to put in charge of it. And ultimately, the president, I think, did the right thing and named Jack Kemp to head it. But then nothing happened. I will never forget, Terry, going into a meeting of the Domestic Policy Council, which was chaired by the president. It was in the cabinet room at the White House. And Bush sat down and he began the meeting, the subject of which was economic empowerment. And around the table, of course, were the senior members of his cabinet, his domestic cabinet, Jack Kemp, Lamar Alexander, Lynn Martin, I think, was there. And Bush opened the meeting by saying, "This is the philosophical heart of what we're all about." Now, if that were the case, and if he truly believed it, I think we would have seen far more activity on economic empowerment, welfare reform, than we saw. And all of this is very sad, very unfortunate, because if you go back to the opening moments of the Bush administration, in George Bush's first speech to Congress in February of 1989, he said very clearly that one of our goals in the Bush administration was to find ways to put more power and authority in the hands of people, to reduce government and let people take charge of their lives. Well, it never happened.
Why do you think it never happened?
Part of it has to do with the personalities. I think Roger Porter was inherently timid. He became very much afraid of Richard Darman.
He was your boss.
He was my immediate boss. He was the assistant to the president for economic and domestic policy. A very smart person, a very capable individual who had had considerable experience, having served in varying capacities under Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, but a very, very risk-averse individual. And, of course, Darman was the exact opposite. He's the man with all the answers, thought he knew everything.
He was the director of the Office of Management
Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and ultimately came, in my judgment, Terry, to crowd out a lot of other people around George Bush, which led me to conclude, and I use this term in the book in White House Days, that George Bush ultimately came to suffer from oxygen depletion. You did not have competing ideas getting into the Oval Office.
Are you suggesting that inter-office politics has a lot to do with which policies get moved on and which stall?
Well, it did in the Bush administration. In fact, one of Baker's key aides, Dennis Ross, commented after the 1992 electoral defeat for George Bush that for months and months, ideas in the Bush White House had been accepted or rejected not on the basis of their merit, but on the basis of who proposed them.
So if the ideas were accepted on the basis of who proposed them, would you be better off putting your ideas into somebody else's hands and letting them propose it?
I joke about that in White House Days. I had a little comment to the effect that if you really wanted to get something done in the Bush White House, find a way to get the idea to Pat Buchanan or the congressional Democrats, and then the scramble would set in the Bush West Wing. That's a little facetious, but it's not all that facetious.
What led you to make that facetious comment?
Well, the fact that a number of things that we talked about had gotten really hadn't gone anywhere. Welfare reform was an example that never got going until fairly late, and then we talked about it as if we were bureaucrats, talking about welfare waivers, and Clinton's out on the stump talking about welfare in ways that appeal to real people. Clinton was talking about ending welfare as we know it. Well, that's a lot more appealing than talking about some sort of bureaucratic waiver. But there were a number of other things that unfortunately did not get off the launching pad.
You write in your book that what you would sometimes do out of frustration is circulate blind copies of your proposals around the White House and engage others in pursuing your ideas. What's the process of doing that?
Just as I said, Terry, you send a copy of a memo. I'd write a memo to Roger Porter or later to Clayton Yeider, and I'd send it to people like Bill Kristol, who was Vice President Quayle's chief of staff, a very, very, very capable person in the White House, or to people in the Cabinet Affairs staff or public liaison, which was the outreach office in the White House, or you try and get it to some of your friends on the speechwriter's staff. And it in some instances, you'd have some success, but it was really sort of government by samizdat. If you remember back in the days of the dissidents in the Soviet Union, when you couldn't communicate publicly, you had to have everything done by these mimeographs. It was sort of underground communication in the Bush White House. There wasn't really an open debate about issues.
My guess is Charles Cobb. He was deputy assistant for domestic policy in the Bush White House. He's written a new memoir about that period called White House Days. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Charles Cobb is my guest, deputy assistant for domestic policy in the Bush White House and author of the new book, White House Days. What was it like to be working on domestic policy in the Bush White House during the Gulf War when the administration and the attention of the nation was obsessed with a war, not on domestic policy?
That fact didn't worry us. Actually, many of us used that time from, let's say, the late fall of 1990 through January, February of 1991 to work on and fine-tune many ideas that we announced early in 1991. Remember, and this is a positive thing to say about what happened in the Bush White House in early 1991, because even during the prosecution of the Gulf War, starting right after the State of the Union address, which I believe was late January of 91, we started a series of what were called domestic rollouts. We had one issue after another, one piece of legislation ready to go to the Congress on a whole host of issues. And the sad thing is that we'd send these things, we'd roll them out and send them to the Congress, and then nothing would happen. We had housing reforms. We had education reforms. We had some international ideas. And all of these things would be handled with fact sheets and press releases and statements. And we'd send them up to Congress. And, of course, the Democrats in Congress weren't stupid. They knew that if they just ran out the clock, they could make George Bush look pretty bad. We never put any pressure, any serious pressure, on the Congress to get those things enacted.
And you think,
but there was a lot going on at that period. So from that perspective, those of us working on domestic policy were pretty busy.
You think that the president wasn't committed enough to those ideas to put any of his political credibility on the line?
I think that's a fair conclusion. Unfortunately, George Bush was in charge. And he was the person who needed to send those signals. And instead, we got caught up in a whole series of turf fights inside the White House. I remember in the fall of 1990, we had this little skirmish over whether we could even use the word empowerment, because Darman and Sununu didn't like the word. But of course, as far as the substance of the issue was concerned, George Bush had already decided that in early 1989 when he said he was for it, in his first speech to Congress. But we'd have these silly things go on that wasted a lot of people's time.
No, I think you had a very basic philosophical difference with George Bush. You count yourself as one of the young conservatives who supported what you describe as the Reagan Revolution, and you saw President Bush as backing away from that instead of carrying it on.
I don't know that I'd say there was a philosophical difference with George Bush, because if you look at the Bush election in 1988, it was basically the third Reagan term. And George Bush ran on principles that had sustained the Reagan coalition for 8 years, most prominent of which, of course, was lower taxes. But you can summarize what Ronald Reagan stood for in six words: less government, lower taxes, stronger defense. I think it's very hard to find six words to summarize George Bush. I've tried, and I've asked people to do it, and they just can't.
Well, somebody who was devoted to process might say that, for instance, you were more ideological, more an ideologue, and that they didn't want to be that ideological. They preferred to focus on the process.
That's possible, but of course, if your sole focus is on process, what are you going to do with it? I mean, process to what purpose? Process is fine. I'm not saying you can't have process, but it's got to be process with a purpose.
At the level that you worked at, deputy assistant to the advisor for domestic policy, how much contact did you actually have with the president?
Not very much. Porter ran the office basically to minimize the contact the staff had and to maximize his own. One day I got a phone call from the president, who called me to ask about a particular piece of legislation. Of course, you'd be in meetings with him all the time. There'd be meetings in the cabinet room or in the Roosevelt room, and a few times I'd be in the Oval Office.
But not speaking to him directly?
Very rarely. Right. And I think that, unfortunately, let me make a point about that, because I think it illustrates something that's important about the difference between the Bush White House and the Clinton administration. I talked about oxygen depletion in the Bush White House. And as the administration wore on, fewer and fewer people had access to George Bush. And I might make the point that was also the case in the second Reagan term. One of my friends who worked in the first Reagan administration said it was remarkable the number of people who had direct access to Ronald Reagan. And then Don Regan came in and cut a lot of that out and made it a much more hierarchical situation. And as my friend points out, we had the Iran-Contra situation in the second Reagan term. I think, unfortunately, the Bush administration evolved as one in which more and more people were progressively cut off from the president. Now, Clinton, I think, much to his credit, is running the White House a little differently. Some people say it's chaotic, that there's confusion, that the meetings run all hours of the night. Well, that chaos may not be so bad, and it may serve Clinton very well, because he may find ways to go outside the traditional loops And whereas what we had was a neat and tidy operation. And I don't think that that served the president that well. Now, Clinton's operation may be tough on the staff. I think that's why you've seen people like the deputy chief of staff, Roy Neal, and the legislative lobbyist, Howard Pastor, leave after less than a year, because I can understand the burnout. But this process that Clinton has set up, this creative tension, if you will, may actually serve him far better than the highly structured process that the Bush administration had.
Well, Charles Cobb, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much for having me on.
Charles Cobb was Deputy Assistant for Domestic Policy in the Bush administration. His new memoir is called White House Days, DAZE, The Unmaking of Domestic Policy in the Bush Years. This is Fresh Air.